From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield.
We have been through a lot together. As I look through the room, I see Jake, Mike, Herman, and Compton. It just seemed like yesterday that I was on the campaign trail and you were analyzing my speeches and my policies.
The Washington Post called President Bush's final press conference wistful. The Los Angeles Times called it wistful. The Associated Press called it wistful. Could they have meant willful?
My friends say, what is it like to deal with the press corps? I said, these are just people that are trying to do the best they possibly can. And so here at the last press conference, I'm interested in answering some of your questions. But mostly I'm interested in saying thank you for the job.
Oh, really? Thank you. I believed him when he said you, but I'm pretty sure thank isn't the verb of one syllable he had in mind, because for the past 8 years, this White House has mainly given the Fourth Estate and the First Amendment the finger. The Bush administration ridiculed the press, ignored the press, stonewalled the press, bullied the press, maneuvered around the press, co-opted the press, censored the press, jailed the press, fabricated for the press, lied to the press, and, for example, when caught illegally wiretapping Americans without a warrant, blamed the press.
It was a shameful act for someone to disclose this very important program in time of war.
This naked contempt for news organizations had something to do with politics. In the calculations of Karl Rove, the media represented a handy foil, an elitist enemy of the president's base.
There's a sense that people in America aren't getting the truth. I'm mindful of the filter through which some news travels, and sometimes you just have to go over the heads of the filter and speak directly to the people, and that's what we will continue to do.
But media filtering was far more pernicious than wedge politics. It was rooted in fundamental administration dogma that how the government goes about conducting the people's business is none of the people's business. This was signaled from the administration's earliest days when Vice President Dick Cheney refused to disclose not only the deliberations of his energy task force, but the identities of oil executives and lobbyists consulted on government policy. After 9/11, that worldview was cemented in the wanton classification of tens of millions of documents in public records and the de facto reversal by then Attorney General John Ashcroft of the Freedom of Information Act. Indeed, the war on terror gave the administration political cover for a wholesale retrenchment on both transparency and citizen rights, sometimes under the authority of the hideously named Patriot Act, sometimes by executive fiat. Alleged combatants were secretly detained, official emails were lost, congressional subpoenas were ignored, through so-called national security letters, unwilling informants were gagged, and on and on and on.
Records from back in the Reagan presidency that had been scheduled for release this year also have been kept under wraps.
The so-called sneak and peek provisions whereby the government can go in and conduct searches without telling a person, take stuff without leaving them in inventory, has not yet been challenged.
You know, the original idea was to have 24 million Americans calling in tips on their neighbors.
Ah, yes, the notorious tips program, asking the FedEx guy to keep his eyes peeled for enemies in our midst. One prominent tipster was Vice Presidential Chief of Staff Scooter Libby, who revealed the identity of CIA officer Valerie Plame to several journalists after Plame's husband, Ambassador Joe Wilson, criticized the administration's pretext for war. Libby, says Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald, was
the first official to disclose this information outside the government to a reporter, and that he lied about it afterwards, under oath and repeatedly.
Wartime brought out the worst in the administration's relationship with the press. High-level leakers fed phony intelligence to New York Times reporters, resulting in stories cited by the administration as supposed independent validation. Dick Cheney on Meet the Press.
There's a story in the New York Times this morning. This is, I don't, and I want to attribute to the Times. I don't want to talk about obviously specific intelligence sources, but it's now public that, in fact...
Add to such manipulation news suppression, such as the Pentagon's refusal to permit photographs of returning flag-draped coffins at Dover Air Force Base, and even fabulism, like Hollywood heroics attributed to Private Jessica Lynch in Iraq and the late Corporal Pat Tillman, who died in a long-covered-up friendly fire incident in Afghanistan. California Congressman Henry Waxman.
We say deceptive, misleading information. It wasn't misleading information. We have false information that was put out to the American people, stories that were fabricated and made up.
Public relations fraud did not end there. The administration staged at least one news conference involving fake reporters lobbing softballs to FEMA officials, and another with the president in a supposedly off-the-cuff Q&A with soldiers in Iraq.
I can tell you over the past 10 months, we've seen a tremendous increase in the capabilities and the confidences of our Iraqi security force partners.
Yeah, that's important. And the American people got to know it, and I appreciate you bringing us that up, Sergeant Major, about what the progress is like.
If you think that sounds scripted and unnatural, you should have seen the dress rehearsal, which was caught on tape. Then there were the payments to columnist Armstrong Williams and others to flog the administration line on No Child Left Behind, the appointment of professional propagandist Ken Tomlinson to the chairmanship of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting in an attempt to neutralize the supposed liberal slant of public radio and TV, and the deployment of a shadow force of retired military officers to shill for the Pentagon on TV news. Turns out that under the Bush FCC, you can't say a naughty word on live TV or expose your nipple, but you can go undercover for the Department of Defense. So, yeah, no wonder the filterer-in-chief in his last press room appearance was suddenly so meek and deferential. Maybe he really was wistful. He did everything in his power to subvert the first rough draft of history, but leaves office knowing that history will have its due.
It has been a honor to work with you. I meant what I said when I first got up here. I wish you all the very best. I wish you and your families all the best.
Well, Mr. President, thank you. No, really, thank you. Forty-two times in the past, the torch has been passed from one president to another, but seldom in American history with the anticipation and expectation that awaits Barack Obama. And his first test will be instantaneous, his inaugural speech to the nation, when he's expected to articulate his vision, frame his program, inspire the masses, quell his critics, and, for good measure, make his mark on rhetorical history. Obama says he's turned for his inspiration to Abraham Lincoln's two inaugurals, deemed the gold standard of the genre, but Harvard historian Jill Lepore thinks he should be aware of the lead standard as well.
You know, the worst, really, is Warren G. Harding. You have to read H.L. Mencken's essay about Warren G. Harding's inaugural address. Mencken hated Harding, and he wrote this essay that just slammed Harding's inaugural piece by piece, just took it apart. You know, it is flap and doodle, Mencken wrote. It is balder and dash. It is the yelping of endless dogs in the night, a string of droopy clothes hanging from a line.
He concluded that the Harding speech was, quote, so bad that a sort of grandeur creeps into it.
You know, one of the things that Mencken hated about Harding was his lack of specificity and then his simultaneous appearance of specificity. Harding had this kind of bureaucratese in which he spoke. So the passage that I think communicates this best is one of these lists. I speak for administrative efficiency, for lightened tax burdens, for sound commercial practices, for adequate credit facilities, for sympathetic concern for all agricultural problems. You know, are you roused to new sacrifices for the nation?
I grant you this. We have nothing to fear but fear itself. It isn't. Since we are in we have nothing to fear but fear itself sort of times, can we expect Obama to strike FDR-ish themes?
I bet his speechwriters are paying a lot of attention to FDR's first inaugural, which is a great example of how a speech that's very well crafted and full of rhetorical flourishes isn't necessarily a deceptive or a pandering speech, and certainly isn't blather. You know, my favorite piece from that speech is when FDR just simply says, "The rulers of the exchange of mankind's goods have failed." There's no buck stops here or whatever kind of mishigas about who did what and who. It's just people were suffering, and it was important to understand that this was a systematic problem and that the only thing that could possibly move forward the American people was frankness and vigor about the nature of the problem itself.
Finally, I want to ask you about expectations. With Barack Obama, he is so famously an orator. If he doesn't actually levitate the crowd, I think we're going to be disappointed. Does that offer a special challenge for the president-elect?
Sure it does. I can't imagine having to be part of that speechwriting team. You know what it would be a much better position would be to have been James Garfield, because I don't think anyone was expecting very much of him. He didn't even want to write the address. He actually kind of told his staff, look, I don't have to. I could just skip this because it really, no one can be as good as Lincoln. Why should I even bother? Why am I even going to try? But Garfield's speech, I think, goes pretty far towards reaching what Lincoln was trying to do in 1865. In 1881, Garfield said to the American people, "My countrymen, we do not now differ in our judgment concerning the controversies of past generations, and 50 years hence our children will not be divided in their opinions concerning our controversies. They will surely bless their fathers and their fathers' God that the Union was preserved, that slavery was overthrown, and that both races were made equal before the law. We may hasten or we may retard, but we cannot prevent the final reconciliation."
And with that, we await the inauguration of the first African-American president. Do you expect any kind of racial themes to infuse President Obama's speech?
I think every inaugural address is a history lesson, and you can't look at American history and not talk about race. I think Obama will talk about it less than he might.
Okay, well, we'll see very soon. Jill, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Jill Lepore is author of The Speech in the January 12th issue of The New Yorker. She's also a professor of history at Harvard University. Coming up, European countries have bailed out their newspapers. Can we do that? This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. President Obama may or may not have a better relationship with reporters than George Bush, but one thing's for sure, he won't have to deal with as many of them. The U.S. newspaper industry is in a tailspin. Onerous debt, declining subscription bases, internet competition, the shrinkage in display advertising, and near oblivion of the classifieds have sucked the profitability out of what until recently was one of the highest margin businesses on earth. The result has been a rash of closings, cutbacks, buyouts, layoffs, and general decimation, with who knows what implications for our media future and democracy itself. All around the world, people are searching for answers, large-scale and small, to keep newspapering stable and relevant, several of which measures we'll look at now. We'll begin with a concept that's just all the rage these days, a bailout. In 1971, facing widespread losses at its many local newspapers, Sweden stepped in with government subsidies, an option being considered today elsewhere in Europe. But what about here? Is the New York Times any less critical to our society than, say, General Motors? Robert Picard, a professor of media economics and director of the Media Management and Transformation Center at Jönköping University in Sweden, points out that the Swedish government stepped in explicitly to preserve public discourse.
Well, Sweden, as most Nordic countries, is a parliamentary democracy. And when you're having 8 to 12 parties, they all want to have a voice and they all want to be heard. And so even in small towns in Sweden, you would have 4 to 6 newspapers that were carrying not only news, but the opinions of the parties and the discourse that was taking place in the political debates of the time. And the idea that those could be lost were considered very frightening to Swedish society because they wanted to continue the kind of debate that is necessary for parliamentary democracy to survive.
And how did the government go about keeping them afloat?
Well, it established a system so that every time a newspaper ad was taken, a tax was placed on it, and this created a fund. Then from this fund, it created a subsidy commission, an agency that was designed to go ahead and distribute the funds that were there to those papers that were not financially successful.
Now, one of the obvious risks of this kind of arrangement is that the papers, now that they're, you know, subject to government largesse, would suddenly start going easy on the government. Did that take place?
There is actually a lot of evidence that reporting actually improved after this occurred, and you had much more tax on issues of the environment, much more tax on the issues of financing. And in fact, the Social Democratic Party, which was in power when this system was developed, was ultimately pushed out of power by centrist coalitions. So they managed to use this subsidies for the purpose of keeping this political discourse going on that they were intended for.
Now, in this country, at least at first blush, it would be unthinkable that the government somehow start funding private newspapers for a whole host of reasons. But actually, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and National Public Radio benefit rather directly from some government subsidy. There are tax breaks and various exemptions to antitrust laws that newspapers have enjoyed. Do you think it's even possible within the framework of this society that papers could be kept afloat based on direct government subsidy?
The biggest problem here, of course, is you're going to have resistance from many in the media companies because, as you've rightly pointed out, there is a great distrust of government here in the United States that is particularly strong and is one of the reasons why we are American and not British. But you have a political reality on top of that, and that is that we have a lot of money that needs to be spent for a lot of services. We have a lot of services of government that are going to be cut over the next few years because of the financial situation of the federal government. And so then we have to ask, why would taxpayers want to keep using tax funds to try to keep alive a product that three-quarters of them don't read anyhow?
And some percent of whom despise to the core of their beings because they represent the enemy.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And then there's a larger question of whether these bailouts even work. Let's go back to Sweden. I'm just curious, these 37 or 8 years later, whether you think that the life support that was given Swedish papers was ultimately successful.
It was successful for a short to medium period of time, but if you look over a period of 20 to 30 years, it's not successful. We've gone from a situation where there were 4 to 6 papers even in relatively small towns to a situation where there's 1 or 2 today. So you've had a huge loss of papers despite the subsidies. So clearly they do not address the underlying economic problems of the newspaper industry.
And yet in France they're looking at a very similar system. You actually have been called in to deal with the plight of Le Monde. Tell me what's going on there.
The Parisian papers are, in fact, in very difficult financial situations. Papers like Le Monde, Libération, Le Figaro, and others. President Sarkozy there has established a commission to try to understand the plight that they're in and to fashion policies that would perhaps help them survive or find a better way to adjust to the current environment. The question becomes, how would they structure it and what would its intent be? Now, the French press is particularly bad online, I have to tell you. They have not picked up in the way that the British press has, the way the German press has. And I think that it's probably likely that the French government will provide some subsidies to help them move more and more online and to develop skills and personnel for doing that.
That said, are there any lessons that we can learn from Europe or any mechanisms that Europe has employed to help us in our predicament with American papers?
If you compare the situation of European papers as a whole to American papers as a whole, they're suffering from the same kind of general economic problems that we are. But their equity structures, their ownership structures, their debt structures are much better than most of the American newspaper companies. And as a result of that, it has created a cushion for them, so they still have a few years to go before they're going to be at the situation we're at today.
Robert, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure to be here with you.
Robert Picard is a professor of media economics at Jönköping University in Sweden and editor of the Journal of Media Business Studies. Subsidies may be a Band-Aid. One publisher is experimenting with a graft. In Chicago, entrepreneur Josh Karp has come up with a product called The Printed Blog, an ink-on-paper daily to launch in Chicago, San Francisco, and New York, and to be distributed free on the street. The twist is that the content will be harvested entirely from web blog posts. That's right, online content printed on presses and delivered by trucks. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Okay, speaking of trucks, aren't you pretty much driving south in the northbound lane?
Well, at first glance, when we describe what we're doing, it might seem that way. But in actuality, we are taking the things that work electronically, and we're going to see if they work with a paper publication.
And the content, as I understand it, will be minutely localized, not just city by city, but varying from distribution point to distribution point. Is that right?
That is right. The technology and our production process allows us to have those local versions based on where you live. And communities, at least in Chicago, they vary greatly even by just a couple of blocks. Each newspaper will reflect the interests of each individual community. So depending on where you pick the paper up, you will be able to come to our website and vote on the blogs that are most interesting to you.
Now, I can see how this is, in many ways, just another form of aggregation, like the Drudge Report or FARC or even Google News, only in printed form. But isn't it also kind of the worst of both worlds? You've got blog content minus the immediacy, minus commentability, minus correctability, all distributed the slow and expensive old-fashioned way at high cost.
First of all, I don't believe the print medium is going away. The experience of consuming something in your hands, having a tactile experience, is not going to be taken over by reading your information on a 2x3-inch BlackBerry or on an iPhone. In terms of the content, we're drawing from a very deep well. There are experts in a wide variety of industries who are writing really compelling information. And we're going to take the best of that content, ask our community to vote on what's important to them, and provide it in a hopefully a wonderful tactile experience.
What about ownership and authorship?
We are not going to print anything that hasn't been explicitly provided to us and that we do not have the rights to reprint. In terms of compensation, once we roll out nationally, bloggers will be compensated based on the advertisements that run next to their blogs. I don't believe it will ever be a substantial sum, but we want to drive people back to the bloggers because that's why they're doing this. Most bloggers are not doing it to earn a living. They're doing it because they have a voice, and they want that voice to be heard.
And actually, that's the economic key to this thing, is it not? The fact that there is a pretty much bottomless reservoir of really fine material that you can reprint at no cost or extremely low cost.
That's one of the economic drivers, Bob, but it's not the only one. Here in Chicago, the Tribune Corporation produces the Red Eye. It's a free daily paper that you can pick up at train stations and numerous other places. If you wish to place an ad in the Red Eye, you spend between $1,000 and many more thousands of dollars, and your ad appears in all 200,000 issues that they produce. With the printed blog, you only have to buy ads for the locations that you're interested in. And the bottom line is that the cost of the ad is dramatically less. It's tens of dollars as opposed to thousands of dollars.
Now, you said that you already have sold ads in your first issue, and good for you. But it's not the first issue that really matters. It's the second one, the third one, and the 4,244th one. Once the novelty wears off, how great is your level of confidence that you can sustain this deal?
Well, if I told you that I had a great confidence level, that wouldn't be the truth. As an entrepreneur and having been one for a while, what I've learned is that I don't have all of the answers. And what we must do is we must go down a path that we think is right and let our readers and our advertisers and our content providers help guide us. I believe there's enough of a starting point that we will be able to find a model that works. But can I tell you that the way the paper is going to look in a couple of weeks when it launches is the way that it's going to look in 3 months or in 9 months or in 18 months? The answer is no. I certainly can't make that promise.
Okay, Josh. Well, all best of luck to you.
Thank you very much, Bob. I appreciate it.
Josh Karp is the publisher of the soon-to-be-launched The Printed Blog. Charles Sennett is the co-founder and executive editor of GlobalPost.com, another attempt to bridge old ways and new. Global Post is a stable of freelance foreign correspondents contracted to file dispatches from, so far, 65 countries. Part of its audience will be at GlobalPost.com itself, but the correspondents' work also will be syndicated to newspapers who otherwise cannot afford to have a reporting presence around the world. And those correspondents will also be available to prepare even more in-depth coverage for businesses or other third-party clientele.
GlobalPost.com right now is live and free. It means you go there and you are immediately confronted with this tremendous body of work. And you then have to ask, well, how are we going to pay all these correspondents if we offer the content for free? Syndication is one piece of it. We're looking for syndication partners, which means we provide them a service, which is 10 news stories a day from our 65 correspondents in the field. They're in more than 45 countries. But there are two other important pieces, and one is online advertising. We're in a very difficult economy, of course. We all know that. But the trend is definitely that advertising is going to the web. It's leaving print, and it's shifting to the web. And our third revenue stream is a membership model. The site is free, but we have a premium content menu of options. I'll give you an example. I've interviewed General Petraeus several times. We would pull out of that as a sound bite, typically about a minute of news that came out of that interview. I mean, that's what I did at the Boston Globe, and that's what we will do on our free website. But on our paid-for site called Passport, there you will have a full profile of General Petraeus. You'll have the full half-hour interview taped. And we offer other products, sort of research products or country profiles as well.
Charlie, most of the foreign reporting that we have seen in the last 6 or 7 years has been from Afghanistan, or principally actually Iraq. Are you going to be prepared as a company to deploy people into war zones with all that that entails?
I've covered Iraq and I've covered Afghanistan extensively, and I really feel like I've shouldered an obligation to be sure if someone is working with us in Iraq or Afghanistan that they're safe. So we've had to be very creative there, given the fact that we're a startup and we have a limited budget. And what we've done is we've partnered. I mean, I can tell you, Jane Aroff, formerly of CNN, is our correspondent in Iraq. She's also going to be working with the Christian Science Monitor. That partnership allows us to be able to afford to have Jane Aroff be a regional editor for us, a sort of analyst, and also help us develop a network of Iraqi stringers who can write for us as well. In Afghanistan, we have Gene McKenzie, who is there full-time working with the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, which has allowed and even encouraged her to work with us because it allows the work she's doing in Afghanistan to reach a wider audience.
So the silver lining of the near oblivion of the newspaper business is that there's just tons of talent out there that you can mobilize. Now, I'm going to assume that the people who are making $150,000 or whatever for the Baltimore Sun in whatever bureau to which they were assigned are not going to be making $150,000 a year from Global Post.
That's why I wouldn't call it a silver lining. I would say that there was a dark storm cloud that's come down upon the news organizations in America, and particularly newspapers. And it's made it very difficult to put together a life of writing about the world in a situation where you live in the country about which you write. And we really require that. All of our correspondents live in the countries about which they write. And what we've found is foreign correspondents are developing a new model in which they'll have a portfolio where they're working for magazines, they're writing a book, and they see us as an interesting new development where they can also contribute daily and also contribute when they want through a reporter's notebook, as we call it, which is actually a blog in search of a better name. It's the old Stringer model, writ large.
Well, Charlie, good luck with this. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Charles Sennett is co-founder and executive editor of GlobalPost.com. Coming up, it's PR business as usual at Gitmo. Has nobody there been informed about this Obama guy? This is On the Media from NPR.
On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Centre at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Next Monday, the 87th Annual Newbery Medal will be awarded for the most distinguished children's book of the year. The Association for Library Service to Children, the division of the American Library Association which gives the award, has been criticized in the past for its selections. For instance, parents have often challenged the 1994 Newbery winner, The Giver, for its troubling subject matter, including euthanasia and infanticide. And 2007 winner The Higher Power of Lucky took heat on taste grounds over the word scrotum on its first page. But according to an article by editor, author, and former children's book publisher Anita Silvey in the October 1st issue of School Library Journal, the biggest problem with recent Newbery winners is that they're just no fun to read. Silvey spoke to librarians and others who believe that the Newbery Commission values sensitive subject matter and stylistic eccentricity to a fault. Pat Scales, a retired middle school librarian, is president of the Association for Library Service to Children and a past chair of both the Newbery and Caldecott Award Committees. She joins us. Pat, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What is the actual intent of the Newbery Award?
The Newbery Award awards for the most distinguished book for the year for children. Popularity is never considered. It is a book that is distinguished in the same way that you might judge an adult book: plot development, character development, delineation of theme, literary style. I do not believe that we have to give up literary merit to get what children will read. A lot of the Newberries have been popular with kids, including some of the ones that Ms. Silvey says that aren't.
There's a piece by Valerie Strauss in the Washington Post. She looked at all the titles from the period of 2000 to 2005.
Right.
And of the 25 honor books, four were on the subject of death, six the absence of one or both parents, four mentally challenged characters, including those with autism.
Right.
And many of the remainder dealt with difficult social issues. I can kind of see why kids don't necessarily want to curl up with this. Does the committee not err on the side of seriousness over, you know, I almost hesitate to use this word, entertainment value?
It's not being fair to the intelligence of children to think that we've got to award for literary merit something that's popular or warm and fuzzy. But in regard to those subjects you just named, let me just say that's life. And it's life that kids today are exposed to. And what a good work of literature does, it helps them along and helps them deal with these things. This is why Bridge to Terabithia has been such a popular book with kids, too. It's a book about friendship, it's a book about family, and it's a book about death. But death is part of life, and these kids are exposed to it a lot.
I think one of the reasons that this is a kind of sensitive subject is that children's book purchases aren't necessarily made by children. On the contrary, they're made by parents and librarians and so forth. And there's probably a tendency to see that embossed gold on the cover and go, ah, well, that's kid safe. And it's got the, you know, Good Housekeeping seal of approval.
I think we're putting too much emphasis on saying to a parent that just because it's got a gold medal means it's for every child. It's not. No more than if a parent walked into a bookstore and they're looking through books for themselves and they pick up one with the Pulitzer Prize winning label on it. Libraries are about choice. And what my theory is, and I've always told children this, if you don't like a book, put it down. Because there are too many good books to try to read a book that you don't like.
I guess the onus is on, as a parent, you know, I got a 7-year-old. I want her to encounter challenging material, but I want her to do it at the right time. At some point, obviously, I want children to learn about the Holocaust, but I don't want them to do it in my first golden book on the Holocaust.
There may be a 7-year-old out there who has family members that were victims of the Holocaust, and maybe their parents want them to read a book like that. I can remember many years ago that we had a child that had been abused, and it was discovered in gym when she dressed out, and there were bruises all over. Within an hour after that gym class, I had 6 copies of a particular book about child abuse. All 6 of those copies went out to her friends. So it's them trying to grasp normal parts of life, and these kids needed to know what had happened to their friend. What we also have to know is that not every book is for every child. So it doesn't mean that there are always books that they're going to curl up with at night. Kids have wide taste, and they read them when they're ready for them. And I actually had a child say to me once, last year I didn't like this book. This year I love it. And what she was saying to me is that she grew up.
Pat, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Pat Scales is president of the Association for Library Service to Children. Have you ever wondered how much the U.S. government gave to, say, Boeing in federal contracts this year? What about Blackwater or GlaxoSmithKline? Now, thanks to a website called usaspending.gov, you can find out. Of course, federal data has always been out there somewhere. But usaspending.gov allows anyone to gather this information with a few keystrokes in seconds. The site is not only revolutionary, it could provide a hint of the Obama administration's plans for government transparency. The site was, after all, created by the Federal Funding Accountability and Transparency Act of 2006, which Obama co-sponsored, much to the delight of the Sunlight Foundation's Greg Ellen. Greg, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, Greg, it's one thing to be technically in compliance with a statute that says you have to make public information publicly available, and another thing to do so in a means that makes it easy for the individual citizen to get access to it. Is that, in fact, what makes usaspending.gov unique?
Precisely. Government must make transparency its responsibility. And in our world, when we say information is public, it means that the information has to be online. And presentation and the data matter as part of being online. 10 years ago, if you were to publish information in PDF documents or Word documents or simply put it up on a web page, that was really pretty far reaching. In 2009 and 2010, online means that you have access to the structured data as well. USAspending.gov is exceptional in that it is end-user searchable, so a human being can come use it, and it has an API so that another computer can come interact with that data.
I apologize to listeners if this gets a little technical, but this is a significant point. API documentation. Why is that critical to this story?
Like most websites, usaspending.gov is powered by a database. So when you go to search for GlaxoSmithKline, you're actually searching the database behind the scenes. usaspending.gov also includes an API or an application programmer's interface, which makes the data available to other people who want to create websites with the data. And we're seeing it where ordinary citizens and very smart people with PhDs and coordinated nonprofits can get in and analyze the data and mix it with data from other sources. It's really wonderful to go to a website and search for an individual company or search for all the government contracts that are being spent in a particular congressional district or state. But if you want to mix that data with census data, or you want to mix that data with information that you get from the SEC, or you want to mix it with campaign finance information, you have to have a way of getting that data out and remixing it with other data sources. And that's what's really exciting about APIs.
This particular website must thrill you, but it cannot be the culmination of all your hopes and dreams for government transparency. What's on your wish list of the three things that you'd like to see Barack Obama do on day one or very soon thereafter?
I think the first one is an executive order stating that social media and technology of Web 2.0 should be used by all the agencies. I think that that's absolutely the first one. We're certainly hopeful that he's going to follow through on his promises to create an ethics.gov site and to make the information of lobbying activity as searchable as the contracts are. I think the other thing is we'd like to see this information available in real time rather than report it twice a year or quarterly or annually, that this information is available as it happens in real time.
Let me ask you one more question. You are the chief evangelist for Sunlight Labs. You're all about transparency. But I'm wondering if there is some logical extension of this process that actually frightens you and makes you get in touch with your inner Cheney. Can this go too far?
I don't think that we can go too far sharing information that is mandated to be publicly disclosed. If you're talking about sharing information which has some secrecy value or raises privacy concerns, that's another matter. But the information that's in usaspending.gov is public information. We can go too far in sharing information poorly. We don't want to include Social Security numbers. That's rather obvious. We don't want to share pictures of our children with personal information, even though it may be necessary to have some of that information on file somewhere. So I think that we have years to go, and there is so much information that we don't have available right now from government that we can go a long, long way before we run into any unintended consequences.
Well, Greg, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Greg Ellen is the chief evangelist for Sunlight Foundation. By the way, Boeing got $27,803,033,138 of federal contracts last year. Now, when it comes to other fronts in the war against government opacity, the Obama administration has some pretty significant battles ahead.
I don't want to be ambiguous about this. We are going to close Guantanamo, and we are going to make sure that the procedures we set up are ones that abide by our Constitution. That is not only
okay,
the right
that's
thing
a plan. Just wondering, though, has anyone, say, Obama's defense secretary-designate Robert Gates, broken this news to the current Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates? Because this week at Guantanamo, things were not only business as usual. The Pentagon was flying foreign journalists in and out of the base to show off the safe, humane, and transparent processes of military justice. Carol Rosenberg covers Guantanamo for the Miami Herald. By the time we spoke to her, the English, Korean, and Chinese reporters had just departed, and she was awaiting the next group of journalists to arrive.
All the foreign press left this morning, and the next batch comes in Saturday.
So you're the only one there?
Yeah, they've got us in a tent city with 120 beds in it, and I'm the only occupant tonight.
Well, there goes the slumber party.
Yes.
So in the interest of transparency, the Pentagon invited foreign journalists, including one from the People's Republic of China, to come. And that reporter was doing her TV stand-up. What happened?
Well, she did her TV stand-up to tape. She was going to take it back to the States and send her story out. But before you leave with any tape, you have to show it to the operational security officer. Actually, he's the censor. So in the background of her stand-up, where she's been taken to do a stand-up, there's a bit of a fluorescent orange barrier, which is a demarcation point for the area where they're keeping the media. And he orders her to destroy the imagery and go out and shoot the stand-up all over again, because you can't have fluorescent orange in your stand-up.
And the Pentagon doesn't want fluorescent orange in your video because...
They say it's a national security issue. People might know how we secure things, I guess, with fluorescent orange. This is one of the most controlled, transparent places you've ever seen.
Why, at this very late stage, go through this process, which sounds an awful lot like PR theater?
They really believe in Guantanamo. There are people at the Pentagon who still think that this is a really good thing. They still are using the exact same talking points they used a couple of years ago about how it's safe, humane, and transparent. And they like to say that, you know, hundreds of journalists from dozens of countries have come and seen it, and this is a totally transparent operation. It's almost like they can't turn the talking point off.
Hasn't that PR battle long since been lost by the Bush administration? Doesn't Guantanamo, in the eyes of the world, stand for illegal detention and worse?
Look, President-elect Obama has said he's going to issue an order to close it, but it's going to take some time. And it's almost like an I told you so from the Bush administration. They said, we wanted to close it too, but you can't just close these things because it was created for good reason. And it's almost like they're still trying to win that PR war by bringing in foreign media and saying, this is something good we've done. This is something important we've done. This has got a bad rap. Soldiers and sailors down here do good work.
There's something confusing about all of this. Obviously, the Bush administration has a very different point of view on Guantanamo than does the incoming Obama administration. But the Secretary of Defense isn't changing. Robert Gates is the Secretary of Defense now. He supports the closing of Guantanamo. Why on his watch is this bit of PR kabuki taking place?
I think the Secretary of Defense has always been preoccupied with Iraq and Afghanistan and hasn't much paid attention to the Guantanamo theme. He said he wants to close it, but he's never changed the talking points. He's left it out there as something that's a problem that he hasn't dealt with. I think that career public affairs officers, when given a message at the Pentagon, deliver that message until someone tells them to stop. There was a prosecutor here yesterday, and we said to him, why are you prosecuting this Sudanese guy when the understanding is this war court's days may be numbered? And he said, I'm an American naval officer. It's full steam ahead until someone tells me to stop. And I guess that nobody's told them to stop.
So the weirdest thing about what you're witnessing there this week is that on Tuesday, it could all just dramatically change. New set of marching orders, brand new talking points, no invitations to foreign press, no message of transparency and humane treatment. It all just goes away.
As a reporter, this is the worrisome part. We still need the answers to the same questions. And there will still be the same people on the other end of the line not answering the questions. So if then they say, we're not even going to put on the show tours and we're not even going to bring media down here because Guantanamo is no longer a story. So if on Tuesday he orders it closed and on Wednesday a bureaucrat at the Pentagon says no more media, how do we cover the story?
Well, wait. So let me see if I got this right. We have the Bush administration for another couple of days putting on, let's just say it's a PR show. But when the incoming Democratic Obama presidency begins, the show may end. But are you suggesting that could actually interfere with reporters getting answers to the questions that remain unanswered to this day?
My question as a journalist down here is, they wouldn't answer us before. If they close it down, or if they decide that they want to close it down, will they start answering us now? The transparency talking point has never been filled in. They've never told us how much money has been spent here. They've never shown us whole parts of the prison camps. There's 10% of the people here on a hunger strike. They'll still be on a hunger strike come Wednesday or Thursday, I suspect, and we won't see it. So the administration changes. The question is, how do we as reporters, with the new let's close Guantanamo talking point, get the answers to the questions that existed today, next week this time?
Carol, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob.
Carol Rosenberg covers Guantanamo for the Miami Herald. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited this week by Consensus. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh and John Delore. We also had help from Dina Prechep. Mike Ventura has been our webmaster, and we wish him good luck as he ventures forth. Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke will be back next week. Meg Ryan will not, as she moves on for the next 3 months to run the Brian Lehrer Show. We will miss her more than end of show credits can credit. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.